I think it was probably some of it was overstaying my welcome, you know, that I think I probably spent too much time there. And I think it was almost like, you know, at the, you know, maybe like you're going into a concert. And at the beginning of the concert, maybe it's like, oh, yeah, this is this great festival and I'm here and the energy's great and the music's great. And it's like we're all these this one family here together. Here we go. And then when it flips on you, it's sort of like, man, I'm just like in this field with like all these muddy people. And like, what am I doing here?
And I'm never going to get out of the parking lot.
And I'm never going to get out of the parking lot. And the water costs 10 bucks. And yeah. what's going on? And so it just sort of flipped. And I think once it flips, it's hard to come back. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's sort of like what was sort of kitschy and quirky is now really commercialist and kind of overdone. And, you know, you're just not going to get that back.
Welcome to Deep Dive with me, Sean C. Fettig. I didn't travel as a child for a handful of reasons, but primarily because it was just cost prohibitive for my family. So instead, I devoured National Geographic and Ranger Rick magazines, and I studied maps, and really anything that would show me something foreign to me. I would daydream about what it would be like to walk the streets of Paris, hike Patagonia, visit a market in Japan or Red Square in Moscow, or take a safari in Africa. I was in my 20s when I first boarded a plane, and in my 30s when I took my first overseas trip. And it really was exactly what I had hoped. On my first big trip, I went to Korea and spent hours just walking the busy streets and listening to the cacophony of voices filling the air, voices that spoke in a language I didn't know. In New Zealand, I stood on clifftops and I'm not ashamed to say wept at the expanse of the ocean. I mean, to see the curve of the earth, to feel that wind blowing in from over the sea, my face being the first it was touching since it was last over land, thousands of miles away in Chile. Marveling at the endless sun in the white nights of St. Petersburg in Russia. And just how silent and isolated the Cook Islands are. How breathtaking that feeling is of detachment from not just people in other corners of the earth, but also from the constant connection, the rushed nature of our crowded lives, the anxiety that comes with the hyper-developed world. I fell in love. Travel, to me, is something life-affirming, inspiring, and fulfilling, something almost necessary. It represents, in part, the ability to make those words and those images in guidebooks and magazines, on billboards, on Instagram, come to life, give them dimension. Not just the sight or description of a place, but also the smells, the sounds, the flavors, the energy. And it makes anything seem possible. Each trip I take reminds me that the confines of my life are often self-imposed, and that should I choose, I could change any aspect of my life, my scenery, my house, the people I interact with or don't, the food I eat, etc. I've only been traveling extensively for about 8 years, which, after everything I just said, might sound remarkable. Maybe not. One of the books that I read in those earlier years of travel and continue to read is Wayfarer's Handbook, A Field Guide for the Independent Traveler by Evan Rice. This book is really unique, kind of in a category of its own, part memoir, part guidebook, part travel hacks, and part utility. There's just good, useful information in this book that you don't know you need until you're trying to speak to a waiter in sub-Saharan Africa in a regional dialect while mentally doing the currency conversion. This book literally helps with that. You also learn how to spot scams, what gestures are best avoided in certain countries, the history of cartography, photo etiquette, how to travel with pets, minimum safe ice thickness for various activities, and much, much more, including travel-related quotes and thoughts from well-known and sometimes not so well-known authors and poets. It's a lot, and it's highly readable. I go back to this book on a regular basis. It's both functional and inspiring. So today, my guest is Evan Rice, the author of Wayfarer's Handbook. In his 20s, Evan left for Africa on a one-way ticket, unsure if he'd be back in 3 days or 3 years. Suffice to say, it wasn't 3 days. We talk about that nomad life, how he did it, why he did it, what travel means to him, some hacks he picked up along the way, some of his favorite places, what motivated him to write such a quirky book, and what the future of travel looks like for him, If you like this episode or any episode, please feel free to give it a like on your favorite podcast platform and or subscribe to the podcast on YouTube. And as always, if you have any thoughts, questions, or comments, please email me at deepdivewithshawn@gmail.com. Let's do a deep dive. Evan Rice, thanks for being here. How are you?
I'm doing great, Sean. How are you?
I'm great too. Thanks. So let's just jump right in. There's a lot I want to touch on with you today. And I think this is a bit of an evolution, both your story and this conversation. So you spent like a significant chunk of your life traveling. You wrote the book, The Wayfarer's Handbook, which I come back to over and over for different reasons. It's such an interesting book. So I want to touch on it. And you've gotten married and had a child. And I want to talk about that too, but also how travel has influenced your life and how your life has influenced travel. And, you know, then I want to pick your brain about some of the things you've learned traveling, maybe some hacks, some suggestions, some of your favorite places, et cetera.
Sounds great. Yeah.
So, but before we get there, I guess I'd like to know, like, I come from a place and a background that didn't really include travel pretty much at all when I was growing up. So I wasn't even on an airplane until my mid-20s, and I hadn't traveled out of the United States until I was about 30. But still, you know, coming up, I was the kid that read National Geographic, and I loved to just look at maps. So I think there was kind of one, an innate curiosity and interest in other places and cultures. But two, I think I was a bit like a pressure cooker. I wanted to travel and I just couldn't and didn't. So all of this desire to travel and see things and meet people outside of my own little world just kept building up. And the idea of being in places that were, no pun intended, foreign to me, not just by virtue of place, but of culture, language, food, my sense of familiarity, et cetera, was just so enticing to me. So I'm wondering what travel means to you. What is the importance of travel? Why do it?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think the importance of travel to me is probably driven by just that innate curiosity. I think the idea that there is so much out there is just overwhelming to me. And I know that rationally and logically, nobody can get to it all, you know, and I reject the idea of travel being thought of as like a kind of like, you know, oh, it's a checklist or a game or a kind of, you know, there's these frameworks where you can say like, well, I've been to this many countries. How many have you been to? All that kind of stuff. Like, I never liked that line of thinking. But when you look at it kind of in a general sense, you're not going to go everywhere. But there's so much out there. Like, I think about, I was on an island off the coast of Ecuador years ago when I first saw the bird, the blue-footed booby. And I just remember seeing that bird, and it was kind of like, it almost looks like something like a kid would draw. You know, it's this like funny-looking bird with these feet that are like this shade of blue that you don't think exists in nature. And it's kind of like, I didn't know anything about this. Like, I didn't know that there's this little island and this little bird is flying around here. Like, it almost makes me mad that, like, that there's all these little gems of kind of beauty and weirdness and craziness out there. And it's kind of like, if I didn't know about this, if I didn't know about this little zany bird with these kind of Dr. Seuss feet that are just running around this island, like, what else is out there that I don't know about, that I haven't experienced, and all this kind of stuff. And so when I think about travel and I think about why do I travel, it's stuff like that, where I'm just sort of like, wait, what is this here? And then there's 10,000 more of those little gems like that. So I think that I'm sustained by the idea that there's some other thing, you know, some other beautiful thing on the next kind of horizon that, well, I want to go see what that's about, type thing.
So then let's talk about how you got there. So in your 20s, you kind of gave yourself over to travel as a full-time thing, which is not unheard of, but it is uncommon, especially at a time in your life when conventional society is pressuring you to, you know, be identifying a career, settling into that career, building your financial security. So I'm wondering if you could tell me what led to that decision. And then from there, you know, how did you structure a life based around travel? And I suppose, you know, what happened?
Yeah, it was a couple of years out of college, and I was working for a very big consulting company in DC, and I was really liking it. You know, it's maybe not really liking it, but I guess it would be more accurate to say I didn't hate it. I do think that there's that's almost kind of scarier, you know, that it's sort of, I think there can be a perception around these things where it's sort of like, you know, the movie version is someone's kind of like, oh, I got nothing else, or I have to reject everything else and go find the road or something like that. And maybe that does happen for some people. But for me, it was sort of like, you know, this is a really solid job. And, you know, this is a great house with some roommates and all that kind of stuff. And so everything was sort of fine. I didn't have like some kind of cartoonishly evil boss or something like that. But it was more, I'd always thought about travel. I had done some study abroad stuff. I'd done a few things earlier in life, but I'd always, you know, kind of had this dream. I'd love to go see what's out there. And thought about it. I realized I was always fascinated by this great migration of wildebeest in East Africa. And, you know, it really could have been anything, but it turned out to be that it was something that I was just sort of like, well, wait a minute, if I really do this soon, I can go see that, like in real life. No more books, no more, you know, watching this on planet Earth. Like, I could go physically see that. And so I was able to kind of latch on to just that one task, that one act, as, all right, let me kind of like shoot for this. And then I kind of got into it from there. What I do remember about that time, and I tell people this a lot, is I was certainly like terrified, and I was very clear with friends and family and loved ones that, you know, I ended up being gone for years, but at the kind of precipice of that first adventure, I was very much like, I might be back in like 3 days, you know, like, I think it was a big undertaking for me personally. Like, I don't want people to think like, oh, I knew it and I was ready for it and all this kind of stuff. I was much more kind of like, hey, I'm gonna kind of roll the dice here and see what happens, but I'm terrified that I'm making the wrong decision and all these kind of things. But yeah, I ended up booking a one-way ticket to Nairobi, Kenya, and I landed. I remember those first days so well, and I don't think I knew before I went the community of people that I would meet. Very few other Americans, and I'm sure we'll talk about that kind of throughout this, but it was all these backpackers who kind of took me under their wing and showed me this way of sort of like, hey, you know, we're just out here. And they showed me a lot of things. I remember like staying in a place in a place called Lake Naivasha, and it was like 40 or 45 bucks a night. And I thought like, man, this is really great. This is such a steal. And then meeting these Australians who were like, dude, what? You're paying like 40 bucks a night? You know, there's other places, there's other hostels, you got to stretch your money, man. And so I learned a lot, and we'll get into all that. But yeah, that's really where it started. And I started meeting people. I just absolutely loved it out there. And I think pretty early on, I knew I'm going to kind of take this as far as it goes.
So I have never traveled in the same way that you have, in that I kind of set aside, you know, a job that I had and kind of had an open-ended approach to travel. I've always had, you know, either I was knowingly between jobs. So I had an end, point at one job and there was a beginning point for another, or I would take something like all of my vacation and then take some unpaid time to travel. Is that me just playing it safe? I don't know. But I know even in my circumstances that were much more secure than the approach that you took, the people in my life were always much more alarmed for me than I was. Very worried that if you're taking unpaid time off, are you going to lose your job doing that? Are you sure that you have enough financial security to do this? Or if I was between jobs, are you positive when you come back you have a job? You're not going to just give up everything, right? Like, you know, the United States is so secure, and you know, to a lot of people, every other place on the planet is not secure. And so I guess I'm wondering, what reaction did you get from the people in your life when you said, I mean, you went much further, right? Like, I'm getting a one-way ticket. I might be back in 3 days, might be a few years.
Yeah, the reaction, you know, I think it was supportive, to be clear. I think a lot of those concerns were there, you know, about security, both job security. I certainly remember kind of like, hey, you know, yeah, how are you leaving things? The kind of don't burn bridges type conversations. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I was sure that it was something I wanted to try. And so I think that gave people some I don't know, hopeful kind of security. I mean, I think in terms of the, well, what are you going to find out there and are you going to be all right type questions, that's really one of the reasons I ended up writing the book. I remember I signed up for these, and you can, you know, they still do it. You can sign up for like travel alerts from the government about like, okay, this area, you know, you shouldn't be going here and all that kind of stuff. And I still get some of those emails. And I would get emails in places that I was in, you know, the emails, they need to err on the side of caution, and you can mm-hmm. sign up, you know, my parents were on those email lists, but it would make it seem like, you know, you're going to step off the kind of plane in Malawi and get shot or something like
right,
that. And it
right.
just wasn't my experience at all. You know, I think I quickly began to kind of tell people like, this is not like we see it at home. I totally agree with you in the idea that like, there's a lot of kind of conversation around, oh yeah, the whole world's a scary place, and there are scary places in the world. But yeah, I kind of kept communicating with people back home, like, this is so much more accessible than you kind of grow up thinking, and you need to get out of that box of kind of like imagining that every place is going to be harmful.
Mm-hmm. Something that I always found interesting is that for a large chunk of this, you were traveling alone. And in that, you set out alone, right? Like, obviously, you were meeting people along the way, right? And I remember my first travel, significant travel overseas by myself. It is a very different experience to travel with people that you know, family or friends, and to travel alone, regardless of whether or not you're meeting people where you're going, you know, but that you are on your own. And I'm wondering if traveling alone, and I don't mean vacationing alone, I mean traveling alone, taps into something differently or means something differently to you than if you are with other people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would say absolutely. I think it's night and day. And I would see this in other people, other solo travelers, where it's sort of, you know, and there's a lot more eloquent writers than I am who've kind of described the phenomenon of, especially when you travel alone, you're not only leaving your hometown and your people behind, you're leaving yourself behind. You're giving yourself the opportunity to be someone else. And I would see that in a lot of different forms. And I think I experienced that in a lot of different forms. You know, I would see that in people who were just kind of decompressing, and you could see them decompressing. I would see that in people who were going totally wild, you know, like kind of party scene, kind of craziness, mm-hmm. who were clearly, you could sort of see it in their eyes, like, this isn't me, this is like Africa me, or this is Southeast Asia mm-hmm. me, and I'm just on my kind of like release kind of thing. Yeah, I mean, I loved the freedom of it and the ability to kind of get outside myself like that. And because of that kind of community that I found, which I didn't really know too much about, the kind of whole backpacker scene, I found myself in a really nice kind of situation of like the being that solo when I wanted to be, and then having the hostel bar there when I wanted that to be, of kind of like, okay, let me go meet some people. And I really ping-ponged between those two extremes. You know, there were definitely months at a time where it felt like I wouldn't speak to anybody else. And then there are times, you know, and I think about these people all the time, but like, you form these super deep kind of road relationships where it's all of a sudden you're not codependent, but you're kind of like friendship on steroids of like, hey, you know, I can remember, Tim from Belgium and Damien from Australia, Pete from England, Lizzie from Ireland. You know, we would form these kind of road families of Sarah and Sana from Sweden, of kind of like, you know, you'd be with these people for a couple months. It'd feel like you knew them your whole life. You're watching each other's backs. And it was these kind of beautiful, albeit brief, relationships. And I think that's a point about kind of traveling solo is you open yourself up to those relationships. I found that to be night and day, the kind of solo perspective of it.
Yeah, there is something about, you call them road relationships, but there's something about them that there's almost like I mean, I suppose depending on, you know, what your goal is, but like an urgency and sometimes maybe even like a survival aspect to that relationship, which means that, you know, you just don't have the time to like nurture the relationship in the same way that you would if you're back home and, you know, you're in a comfortable setting. You know, sometimes you really just have to find a place that you're going to sleep tonight, and we need everybody to help with that. And that just, you know, like you develop relationships in different ways than you do.
Absolutely.
Otherwise,
yeah. It's cool. I don't know. I always like that. Yeah, you find yourself kind of like relying on people like you wouldn't have thought, and learning from those people. You know, as I mentioned at the front, like I really felt like when I first started that I was almost the mentee of people. You know, I'd meet these people who seemed to have been everywhere, and they'd have been out on the road for a long time, and they were so kind of relaxed but aware. You know, they could. You know, I was still in the kind of like, oh, I've got like my hand on like my money belt under like my shirt. Mm-hmm. And these people kind of were like just flowing through these crowds of people. But they seem to have kind of a sixth sense about, okay, I kind of know where everything is. I'm not stressed. I'm not, you know, I kind of am expecting the bus to get delayed. You know, the new people are all freaking out like, wait a minute, you said we were leaving at 1 p.m. and now it's 3 p.m. and we haven't left this bus. And these people were kind of like, no, I've got like this great novel that I'm reading and I'm cool because I've seen it all. And I sort of learned a lot from those people, like the kind of specific, almost, you know, tactical type stuff, and that mentality of sort of, you know, they haggling with people. They're never mad. They're treating it as a game. They have this great mentality around them. And I thought, wow, that's cool. Like I want to, you know, learn that. And then I like to think that later on, and I can remember times, especially in South America, that it was like, you know, I remember Danilo, like this younger guy from Argentina who I almost felt like a mentor for, kind of, you know, it was like one of his first big trips. And it was sort of, hey, you know, this is kind of, let me show you the way type thing. And it wasn't as official as all that, but you know, just kind of learning those lessons and forming those relationships was always a special part to me.
How did you design your life to sustain travel without, I mean, ostensibly, I suppose, a job, right? Or at least a career. Like, how did you make that work? Because I think to a lot of people, that's the thing that's stopping them.
Totally. I think one of the points that I love to stress and tried to stress with the book is that travel is so much more accessible than people think. And I obviously genuinely believe that, but it's also a privilege. You know, it takes less money than a lot of people think. It still takes money. And so that's like, you know, I never want to imply that like any single person, you should just be throwing everything away and getting on the road. Cause that's really not the reality. So for my particular situation, it was a couple things. Because I had been working for a couple of years before I went out on the road, and I didn't have any debt, I was able to save a little bit of money before I went out. And then once I got out on the road, I quickly realized, okay, this is something that's important to me. And I want to do this for as long as I can in this format, you know, just kind of bouncing around. And so kind of right when that happened, relatively large parts of the kind of global map were crossed off, at least for the short term. And so by that, I mean, you know, anywhere in Europe and Scandinavia, yeah. You know, that's obviously out. You know, you meet a lot of people who are, you know, Australia and New Zealand to go work and make some money for a few months. But that kind of wasn't my path. And so I thought, okay, it's East Africa without spending too much time in South Africa. It's Southeast Asia on the really established, you know, kind of routes there. And then it's, you know, South America. But I remember like, at least when I was there, the visa fee to get into Brazil was like $300. So like that was totally out. Like, no, we're not doing that. And I would meet so many, you know, Germans and Dutch and Australians who seemed so familiar to this, but it really wasn't familiar to me at the time, was I was staying not only in the kind of the hostel scene, but the super cheap hostel scene. So that means dorm rooms, you know, in some parts of the world, that's, you know, maybe six or eight others. In the more kind of backpacker hotspots, that's like maybe 30 people in a room. And sometimes in like these terrible mattresses. at the point in my life where I am now, I'm not sure I'd want to kind of be back in that Cambodian hostel doing that. But at that time, it was sort of like, hey, this is $3 a night. So I'm doing that. So it was money saved plus the cheapest of the cheap. I didn't take flights unless I was flying in or out of a continent. You know, a lot of like 20-hour bus rides, that kind of thing. Street food, you know, saving money anywhere I could. And then, you know, the kind of the road jobs, especially younger, you know, the hostels, they need staff. And so it'd be like, okay, you know, if you bartend for us for a month, you can stay here for free or whatever it is. And so there were a couple short-term gigs like that. And then obviously I got into writing more and more. But yeah, it was stretching the money as far as I could go, with a big element of that being like the overall location where I am is going to be the biggest determining factor of that. So I can't think about these certain countries right now just because the budget's not going to be there.
There's an interesting phenomenon that's happened with me, and I don't know if it resonates with you in any way, but so when I was first traveling, I mean, and this is also the difference between things like travel, I suppose, and vacation and, you know, relaxation. But when I was first traveling extensively, I was doing a lot of this, right? Like really low budget, bargain hunting, staying in hostels, and really enjoying it. And that was a very unique experience. And then I took some time off to get myself a bit more settled. And then now when I travel, you know, I'm in a different place. And I probably, to be honest, have a little less time to commit as I did when I was younger. So I'm spending more money, I think, to avoid some of the quote unquote inconveniences that I was much more willing to accept when I was younger. But because I had that experience and I was so embedded in this idea of like really bargain traveling, that like nothing seems worth it to me anymore. And so I spend a lot of my time traveling now thinking, well, that's, you know, I paid this money, but it's not worth it. And it's like this weird dynamic where I'm like, I'm willing to pay a little bit more, but I'm never quite feeling like it really brings me the same joy in the same way as when I was really like, you know, working through it, you know?
I do. Yeah. And I mean, I think part of that is there's a degree to which obviously that type of budget travel is the younger person's game. Yeah. I'm also like, I think at the point we're ready to pay out of some of those inconveniences. And is it looking back with kind of like rose colored glasses? But yeah, I totally hear you. I do think when you're at that point in life where you're ready to kind of like deal with those inconveniences, those can lead to some of the coolest times. So I think it's about like finding that balance of kind of, I don't, and I don't think you do either, want to cut myself off via money from the kind of like the authenticity of a place. But yeah, I also don't want to sleep in a room with 30 other people anymore.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think there's a balance to be found.
So I mentioned this in another episode, and you've actually touched on this a little bit already, but when I travel, which is probably more extensively, I think, than like society, at least in the United States, we really do have this mindset of like, you get 2 weeks a year. If you're lucky in certain, you know, industries, you might have some more, but typically you get 2 weeks a year. So we have this like lens of vacation, which is that we take 1 week at a time, and that 1 week is just about relaxation. And I get that, but I've never been super comfortable with that. So for me, it's all about like hoarding as much time as I can and then traveling, right? But a lot of people, or I've run into people that do look at this kind of skeptically, and they make some assumptions that, you know, either I'm independently wealthy, and again, like you touched a little bit on this, but, you know, I'm not, or that I don't have any like responsibility in my life outside of myself, which is also not true. The reality is that I've just put a value on travel, which means that I structure my life to include it. So there are things in my life that I have to sacrifice as a result, right? And I'm wondering if you've experienced this and how you respond to it.
Yeah, I think I really have. And I think it is, as you noted, to a degree, uniquely American. As I mentioned before, I would meet people, so many other people of all these different countries on the road where this seemed so commonplace. And not only the idea of like the gap year, you know, which is obviously a little bit more focused on a younger set, but the idea of just getting out in the world. And I think there's, you know, a million reasons you can point to about that, maybe, you know, geography chief among them. of just kind of where the U.S. is compared to other places. And so I think that there's a piece of that there. I think the stereotype of the traveler or the person focused on travel as the drifter kind of, I don't want to say hippie, but kind of, you know, if you're prioritizing that, you must, as you said, have no responsibilities at home, I think is persistent and it's frustrating. I think one of the ways that I deal with it or would deal with that perception is the kind of the secure knowledge within myself that I'm going to look back and be happy that I prioritized this. You know, I think one of the persistent thoughts when I first started traveling was the idea of, because I don't want to look back and be like, where did all that time go? You know, I kept this great job, but now I'm, you know, retiring and what did I do kind of thing. And so I think I can deal with the idea of someone saying, okay, oh yeah, it must be nice that you can just bounce around and not think about anything, though that's not the reality, because I have the kind of thing in my mind of, well, I think I'm really going to be glad that I took that opportunity to bounce around. And again, the act of bouncing around does not mean no responsibilities or, you know, that everybody has a trust fund or something like that. Mm. And so, yeah, maybe it's that kind of like tucked away thought of like, hey, I really, really valued these experiences. This was incredibly important to me personally. And so I'm treasuring them. And if others can't get behind that, that's their loss.
Let's talk about Wayfarer's Handbook. You know, I've said this to you, but this book is unconventionally structured. It's structured like a field guide, which is what its subtitle is, right? But
it is.
The book actually, I mean, kind of blows my mind, and this is why, because it's got so much information that is interesting and useful that I think most people don't even know that they might need, and yet it all feels so important. And the second reason it kind of blows my mind is that I'm not sure how one person keeps all of that in his head and is able to like and recognizes that is important and interesting information and then translates that into a book. So, I mean, this is really a functional question. Like, how did this idea come to you? And then why did you structure it this way? And how did you decide that was the information you were going to put in there?
Well, that's very kind, first of all. So thank you. Yeah, I think a couple things were happening at the same time. I've been on the road for a long time and I, you know, had a million scraps of paper, you know, of just little ideas or little notes or little kind of experiences, you know, of just sort of like, man, I remember that night, you know, in Mozambique when I stayed up all night and I was so thirsty and I didn't buy a bottle, you know, I'd forgotten to buy a bottle of water. And so I just remember staring at this faucet that I knew I couldn't drink from. It would make me sick, but I couldn't sleep because it was so hot. And I just thought, I will never, ever do that again. I will never go to bed without a bottle of water ever again. And so it's just sort of like, okay, that's something I've learned. I remember, as I talked to you about, it kind of hit on earlier, is just the idea of the buses might not run on time everywhere. And then the rest of the world is not as specific as maybe the U.S. is. And just that was a really interesting idea to me. And I thought, okay, that's something I'm really noticing, that people come here and they think they have this mentality of the shop opens at this time and the bus leaves at this time. And that's not how it works everywhere. And so you have to change your mentality. If you go in with that wrong mentality, you're going to kind of set yourself up to be frustrated. So I would kind of pick up things like that. And then I'm going around and I'm seeing travel changing. The internet obviously has changed everything, and it was changing travel while I was out there. The classic, you know, overworked Lonely Planet book that people used to carry, are they still carrying it? You know, is that information being replaced by the internet? And then what is the value of destination specific information anymore? That's something I would think about a lot, that why do we need a book or anything telling us where we should go? Isn't that the opposite of what we should be doing? Mm-hmm. Don't we want to not go where everybody else is going? You know, so where do those things kind of like fit in? And so I was thinking about a lot of those concepts. And then a lot of it is what we talked about earlier. You know, I would come home, I would get people being like, oh, wow, you know, you were in Mozambique, you know, it must have been so dangerous. And it was sort of like, you know, yeah, Mozambique can be dangerous if you're thinking about it the wrong way. But it's also like, you know, I'm from Baltimore. Baltimore can be really dangerous, too. Mm-hmm. If you're going to be drunk and alone in the middle of Baltimore, you might get in a bad situation. Same thing in Mozambique. And so that, you know, there's all these misperceptions about travel from the American audience. You know, as I mentioned, I travel with all these people who made it seem so natural where they came from. And then friends from the U.S. maybe didn't make it seem like that. So all these ideas were kind of swirling around. And I thought, okay, what about something that's not destination specific, that the through line of travel is accessible, is super important to me. And so the idea of designing a book that makes it seem like a thick, dense, difficult to get through, hey, you better read this instruction manual before you kind of pull the ripcord, was the exact opposite of what I wanted to do. And I mentioned this in the prologue of this book, like, you don't even really need this to travel, you know, like travel is that accessible. You'll learn on the road. And so I thought a way that I could avoid that feeling of somebody being like, oh man, I was just kind of like kicking this around in my head. And now this is like a 300 page instruction manual. I'm not into that, was sort of like, hey, let's combo that information that could be useful with a bunch of inspiration, you know, quotes that I love mm-hmm. from writers or cool pieces of information or all this kind of stuff. And let's put a lot of design behind it, nice little drawings or maps or kind of graphics or things like that. And so, and this is something I talk to publishers about a lot is, you know, this new age of travelers who's emboldened by the internet, who is always going to have their phone and does not need this destination specific information, and is probably rejecting the idea of a big text-heavy book, we can give them the design, we can mix the information that we're trying to get across with inspiration, with some really cool stories along the way, and give people a product that kind of speaks to them and is snackable in that way, you know, that they don't need to like invest a huge amount of kind of mental energy to read those 300 pages. It's more like, hey, I can pop in here, couple cool stories, couple cool tips, and I'm back out on the road. And I feel like this is, you know, I love the writer Douglas Adams, you know, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy mm-hmm. and all his stuff. And, you know, it was always that kind of like that mix of curiosity. And it's, you know, the universe is a really, it's first and foremost, it's interesting. It's funny. It's weird and quirky. And so like, let's get that across in the book. Let's keep it not light, but let's keep it as interesting as the world shows that it is. And so all those kind of things swirl together into the book.
So you bring up something that, I don't know, I want to dig into a little bit. So you mentioned, you know, the internet and this perhaps replacing destination-specific books, like how particularly useful are they except to crowd places with people, right? Now, whenever you see those like top 10 destinations in 2022, to visit, you know, I'm always like, okay, here's the list of places we're not visiting this year. But so this book, it's been a handful of years. And I suppose, you know, then, you know, there was the COVID intervention since Wayfarer's Handbook came out. And I almost feel like at this point, the internet is most likely the sole source for most travelers. And I'm wondering if you see pitfalls in that, or if we've lost something maybe romantic in travel that, and the reason I ask, because I think Wayfarer's Handbook is to some degree somewhat timeless and does speak to that kind of romantic idea of what travel is. And I wonder if we're losing something, I guess, in, you know, having something like the internet, which is synthesizing supposedly everything we think we need to know about where to go and how to do it.
I think we are. I think that's well put. I think the internet's effect on travel can be one that is such a powerful influence on people before they're going anywhere, if they're going at all, that can tunnel vision their trip, I think is something that I see a lot. I guess an example I would use, and to be clear, I'm not above any of this. Like, I'm not saying this is all these people are lit like this and I'm the only one who can see this, and because right. This certainly affects me too. But it's the idea of, you know, I did my rant about destination specific information, you know, the old kind of maybe the Lonely Planet that, you know, is sending everybody to the same restaurant. the pitfalls there. But there's something to be said now about, well, now everybody's building around, oh, well, I want to go there and get that Instagram picture, you know, and you see that on the road now where it's like, you know, a lot of places you can line up to, here's the iconic Instagram picture that you get here. And it gives people that tunnel vision of maybe there's a cool beach restaurant on the way to that Instagram picture and that's rejected because no, I'm going to get that picture. And then maybe there's this cool experience over here. And it's that sort of the living out of a trip that you've seen before, you know, so beautifully rendered via the internet, giving people tunnel vision. And so there's certainly a loss of romanticism because I think we're the same in that we love those touchstones of like, man, look at this beautiful old map and these incredible travel stories. And so I think that there's something lost there. There is no going back from it, but I do think that there's the internet being so visual changes people in a way that they kind of have an expectation of a trip. And then in a lot of cases, it doesn't really look like that picture. You know, when you're there, you shouldn't be traveling for that picture. So it's something that I certainly always try to be aware of kind of like, I'm going to a place with an open mind rather than kind of chasing something that I've seen. I try to, at least.
I mean, admittedly, I am really struggling with travel these days because, so Instagram, I used to be a relatively active presence on Instagram. I used to be on Facebook and be in these travel groups. And I feel like what's happened, and it happened really quickly, is almost like the commodification of, you know, the photo of a place. And so every place has millions of photos and they're almost exactly the same. And you go places now and you see people that aren't even looking up from their phones and they're just taking a photo and moving on. Mm-hmm. And you know that's immediately being uploaded onto Instagram. And the impact that's had on me is I have found that my last few big trips, I've actually not even taken any photos because it's made me wonder or question, like, what is the purpose of those photos actually? You know, the photo is not the experience you're having. It's capturing something, but it's not the experience that you're having. And it seems like Wayfarer's Handbook, as it's written, and the intent of it really is a rebuttal to that. If you were to write Wayfarer's Handbook now, or if you were to be promoting it now, how would you do that in this environment?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. I think that, I guess there's a side of my mind that is the internet is here to stay, you know, and I don't want to be the crotchety old guy who's, you know, okay, what's going on with Instagram, that kind of thing. And I touch on this a little bit in the book, but I do encourage people to reject the idea of traveling for other people, you know, like it's not save something for yourself, but it is that if you are in the content loop of what's my next post, then that's work for other people. You know, that's output for other people that does take you out of the place that you are a little bit. And as I said, like in terms of like those kind of road relationships, social media was certainly around then, you know, this wasn't 100 years ago, but I like to think that like those searches for connection happened because me and all those other people were searching for connection. And I do think that there's something where it's like, if you are just locked to that phone and your mind is home, but your body is somewhere else, then it's sort of like, then kind of there's a degree to what's the point of being here if you're kind of like mentally still home and still kind of in that loop. And so I'm not sure if I would promote the book differently, but I do think that the idea of if the term is kind of like travel selfishly becomes more and more important as those kind of structures, like the kind of Instagramification of travel, become more pronounced. Yeah, the idea of travel selfishly, I think is increasingly more important, and I think I wouldn't frame it as this is inherently a negative. It's more like this can quickly become a negative if you're doing it for the wrong reason. Mm.
Okay, let's shift to something tangible. So you provide a lot of suggestions in Wayfarer's Handbook, but What are some practical travel hacks you could offer?
You know, that's a really good question. I think one thing that used to stress me out was, am I bringing the right stuff? And I think operating under the knowledge that, like, pretty much wherever you're going, people have lived comfortably for thousands of years should give you a sense of peace. You know what I mean? Like, there's so much, the travel industry is and will always be huge. And so there's a lot of kind of like productizing of it, like, oh, you need this or you need that or whatever it is. And I'll be the first to admit, like, I remember on some of my first big trips, I would like bring a bunch of rope all the time. Like, I was like Indiana Jones, like, man, I'm going to need like this rope. And it's sort of like, I don't know where I thought I was going, but I would just bring these things that I would think like, oh man, this is like, you know, I got to have all this stuff. And it was this massively heavy pack filled with things I wasn't using. And so just the knowledge that like, you're going to be fine, you know, like in terms of like kind of tech and kind of like the products that you're bringing. Like I always tell people, don't overthink that. And then I kind of mentioned this earlier, but I think it's really important. Going into a place with the open mind in all the different things that we've talked about, but not imposing where you're coming from on where you're going, right? You know, like I think something that used to drive me crazy until I sort of just got the right mentality was like menus. I think I always thought of a menu as like, this is what this restaurant has, you know? And so if you don't have this, if I say, oh, I'll have this, and you say, oh, well, that's not available, it's almost like you're breaking a contract. And then that very rarely happens in the US, you know? It's almost like they would send over the manager to apologize. Oh, I'm so sorry, we're out of the chicken or whatever it is. But you go to places, especially more remote places, and I always found that's really not, it's almost like the menu is kind of like a general guide to this is the kind of food, but you know, we don't have all these dishes. And so if you come in like intense like that, like kind of all sort of, oh man, I'm going to get exactly this. And this is what's kind of driving my satisfaction of this meal and this place and all this kind of stuff. You're setting yourself up for failure. And so not imposing those kind of like that kind of specificity on places, I think is really important. And then just, you know, and this is broad and therefore, like, I hope not tactical enough, but understanding how the world works in a lot of ways and being ready to roll with what happens. You know, I mentioned like learning lessons from people. I remember I was traveling with two women from Sweden and we were in Malawi. They were out for the day at this market. And they got robbed and they lost like all their stuff. They lost like their passports, cameras, everything. And they came back and they dealt with it. Like in the Swedes don't have an embassy in Malawi. So it was like this huge thing to get them new passports. But I traveled with them for months after that, you know, and these kind of travel routes, as you go, maybe if you're going south through a place, you meet people who are coming north. And you're trading tips all the time. Like, oh, where should I go? Oh, man. Oh, okay. All right. Oh, shouldn't do that. Or, all right. Oh, well, that's the really cheap hostel. Okay, cool. Thanks for telling us that and all this kind of stuff. So I traveled with these women for months after they had gotten like really significantly robbed. And they never let it affect them. You know, people would say, how's Malawi? And lesser travelers would have, you know, been like, oh, it's terrible. Oh, they robbed us and it's everybody in Malawi's a thief and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And they just, you know, they refuse to let it define them. They're just sort of like, yeah, you know, it's a beautiful place and those people are beautiful and all this kind of stuff. And they, you know, it's not that you don't warn people about things like that, but it taught me such a lesson of sort of like, hey, like as much as you can kind of not letting singular bad events really significantly affect an entire trip. Like a lot of people would have flown home after that and they just kind of dealt with it so well. So I know that's not super tactical, but just the overall idea of kind of like, I don't know, as much as you can, keeping that mentality of like singular events don't define entire people or entire countries and moving on from there.
So I'm sure you've heard this, that it's not the place that makes you happy, that, you know, happiness comes from inside yourself and that by extension, you can tap into that wherever you go. And I don't know that I completely buy that. I do think that places have energy that can tap into something that brings out different things in us. So, you know, some things might resonate more so with me than with you. I might actually just not enjoy a place, and that does kind of impact my life in different ways. And so I wonder why we don't lean into that, why we don't, you know, accept that place might be able to tap into both, you know, positive and I suppose negative in us, and that it might be important for us to recognize that. And so I'm wondering, you know, what are some places that have brought you joy just by virtue of place? And then are there any places that just haven't resonated with you?
Yeah. So I think luckily there's more of the former, you know. I think there's more that have brought me joy by virtue of the place, but I do think that happens. I think that not everywhere is for everybody. And I agree with you that it's okay to say that. In terms of places that have brought me joy just by virtue of the place, I think there's a lot. Things that come to mind are Santa Marta, Colombia, on the kind of north coast there, I thought is just a beautiful town. It was the right size for me. You know what I mean? It was kind of like big enough, but not too big. And it was kind of happening enough, but not too happening. And then it's that kind of like cosmic mix of stuff of just like, look at the sunset, you know, look at this beautiful little restaurant and it's filled with sand and it's just this lovely food and these lovely people and all that kind of stuff. And so that would be an example of the place where, you know, I dream about going back to. I want to bring my wife and daughter there and all those kind of places just because it was so joyful to me. Places that haven't resonated. Yeah, like Montanita, Peru. This little surf town, you know, I think it just turned on me. And again, that's okay. And that's the beauty of travel, right? That it's sort of like, especially solo and independent travel, where you're just kind of like, I mean, I'll tell you, the joy of getting on the bus out of there was just this kind of like, oh, wow, I'm leaving that behind. And I'm on to the next place. And sort of, here we go. I think what happened was probably some of it was overstaying my welcome, you know, that I think I probably spent too much time there. And I think it was almost like, you know, at the, you know, maybe like you're going into a concert and at the beginning of the concert, maybe it's like, oh yeah, this is this great festival and I'm here and the energy's great and the music's great. And it's like, we're all this one family here together, here we go. And then when it flips on you, it's sort of like, man, I'm just like in this field with like all these muddy people. And like, what am I doing here?
And I'm never going to get out of the parking lot.
And I'm never going to get out of the parking lot. And the water costs $10. And yeah. What's going on? And so it just sort of flipped. And I think once it flips, it's hard to come back. You know what I mean? It's sort of like what was sort of kitschy and quirky is now really commercialist and kind of overdone. And, you know, you're just not going to get that back. I don't know. That's why I certainly like the idea of lack of structure and lack of planning as the antidote to some of that sort of stuff, to just be like, hey, this is not kind of where the wind is taking me. And that's all right. And I remember, you know, that town in Peru I mentioned, I remember it came highly recommended, you know, by the other kind of travelers that on the road, oh, you got to check that place out. And it was just sort of like, man, I'm not feeling this, you know, onto the next.
A place that brings me joy that, and for reasons I can't quite explain, is the eastern coast of the South Island of New Zealand. There's just something about, I don't know if you've been to New Zealand, but there's something about that coast and that, like, it's like the sun coming up, it's almost like the first in the world, and you can just almost feel that. It's absolutely amazing. And the ocean seems endless from there.
Oh, I want to go. Oh, that sounds incredible.
But a place that has not resonated with me, and maybe this makes sense, is like the Tulum area of Mexico.
Yeah.
I really always wanted to go. And I was just like, an afternoon and I'm good. I'm done.
Really? That's so interesting. I've never been. I've heard a lot about Tulum. And that's super interesting. It just wasn't, was it too much or was it just, you just kind of weren't feeling it?
I think it was a bit of both. So I definitely bought into the mystique of the Tulum area. So the cenotes and the ruins. So, and it makes sense, right? Like Tulum itself, Tulum proper, is just overrun with tourists. Okay. But even the cenotes and the ruins just did not resonate. I was just kind of like, and I don't mean to be dismissive. It's just for me, I was just kind of like, okay. I think I also expected it to resonate way more than it did.
Yeah, I think that certainly happened to me before too. Like the idea of, yeah, just going in with a super high kind of internal bar of just like, man, this is going to check every box. And I think sometimes it does. Like that's, I met a really interesting guy once who, there were all these people kind of denigrating the idea of, you know, touristy, you know, and I'm sure you've experienced that too. Like, I'm the kind of real one out here and I won't go anywhere that's touristy and I'm blazing my own path and all this kind of stuff. And you know, I traveled with this guy for a while and his perspective, which I agree with, is like some stuff is touristy because it's the best stuff and yeah. That's okay. You know, it's sort of like, I think of like Machu Picchu and Angkor Wat. Machu Picchu in South America, Angkor Wat in Cambodia, obviously, are incredible. Like they're so well known, but they're so well known because they're so iconic. Mm-hmm. And it's just sort of like, I just would laugh at these people who are like, no, I'm not going to do Machu Picchu because it's so touristy. And yeah, Machu Picchu is overrun with people, but it's a stunning ruin in the middle of a gorgeous jungle. And so it's, I don't know. It's finding the line between those two things.
And yeah, I was just going to say, it is definitely a balance because I've been in that boat where I'm like, oh, I really want to avoid tourists. I want to avoid people. But then 2 days in, I'm kind of like, I would really go for like, like a cold, clean water right now. And I know they have that in Tulum. So, okay. So you're married now and you mentioned your daughter. And I'm wondering, so that means obviously you can't, you know, do the same thing you did in your, you know, mid-20s. As it relates to travel. So I'm wondering how it has influenced your travel. And then if you're at all interested on doing this, how do you pass that value on to your child?
Yeah. I mean, it certainly influenced it a lot. You know, I think that there's in the realm of independent travel and the type that I was doing when I was younger, I do think that it's not a definitive choice to be made, but I met a lot of people along the way that had made the very conscious choice. And I traveled with a lot of these people for months on end who had made the very conscious choice that this is not only going to be like an important part of my life, or this is not only an important experience to me. This is my experience. Like this is how I want to live essentially the rest of my life. And I deeply respect those people. And there's a massive community of them. You know, I remember talking to all these people, and it would be kind of like, you know, a huge amount of like seasonal work. There was this like legendary Norwegian cruise line that people used to talk about of like, man, if you can get a job on this cruise line, you can make enough in 2 months to like travel the rest of the year. I'd meet all these people that did that, or, you know, seasonal farming or all these kinds of things. And then there's the, you know, that kind of dream of, oh, I'm going to open a hostel here, you know, instead of being the person passing through all these hostels, I'm going to open up my own spot. I met a lot of people that did that and did it beautifully and brilliantly in a lot of really, really cool parts of the world. But I think for me, I would meet those people and I would kind of see the route that they went on. And I thought it was wonderful, but I always knew, hey, there is a point for me, like, where I do want to go back to Baltimore and I do want to settle down and I do want to write this book and I do want to do these things. And so as much as I respect travel, I don't see myself doing that, you know, couple months of work to stay on the road, like in a significant part of life, you know, going forward. And I think there was a part of me that always knew that. And so obviously at the point in life I am, like at the moment, you know, my daughter's extremely young, you know, we just kind of had her. And so we're very homebound. I think of raising her and I think of like passing this on as one, I'm not going to be the person. And I don't think I'm this now where I'm not reliving my stories of the road all the time. It's not that, but I think it is extremely important to me to instill a curiosity about the world and a worldview that is inherently open and optimistic. And I think it kind of gets back to some of the stuff we've talked about in this conversation of, the fear kind of industry of scaring you about the world is aggressive and consistent and will never go away. Mm-hmm. And I think if that is not actively battled against, then there is the implication of why would I go anywhere else? Or, you know, everything is scary. Everybody's out to get me. And I think if you're raised in a way, and it's often subconscious, where you let that paranoia put you in a box, then it's extremely hard to break out of that box. Hmm. And, you know, my parents were very big on us. Like, you know, we traveled a good amount as kids, and I got to have some really beautiful experiences. You know, I think when I was like 13, I was able to spend a summer in Germany and Russia. Mm-hmm. With some family friends, but just totally on my own, which was without my family, which was super cool. And I think a lot of those experiences instilled a lot of like, hey, I want to get out and do more of this. And so I guess I don't view it as, you know, I'm not sure we're going to do the, I remember like meeting the families of the road, you know, who would do like the, hey, we like renovated this RV and we're driving from, you know, Mexico to Argentina or something like that, you know, with a couple boats in between. Whether we're going to hop out on an adventure like that, I'm not sure. But I think it's going to be extremely important to me to express a, hey, there's adventure calling, you know, mm-hmm. then there's adventure possible to you and available if you want to go seek it when you're a little bit older.
Okay. Final question. What's something interesting you've been reading, watching, listening to, or doing lately? And it doesn't have to be related to this topic, but it can be.
Okay. I'm going to give just a song that I think is the most perfect travel song of all time. I think it's poetry put to music, and it's one of my favorite songs of all time. And it's not particularly well known, but anybody that's listening to my voice, if you're out on the road or if you're not, I'd really suggest this song. It's called Oh, I Wept by a band called Free, a band from the early 70s, I think. And it's not, you know, if you Google the most famous kind of like on the road type songs, I don't think this will come up. But when I think about what drove me to travel, or I think about the experience of being on the road, I think this song kind of suits that more elegantly than I ever could express. So yeah, I've always loved that song, and I always think of it like that's a classic traveler tune that is not classic enough to a lot of people. Oh, I Wept by Free.
That's a great response. I don't know that song, so I'm totally going to check that out. But it's also making me think, what a great like conversation to have with travelers. Like, what are your favorite songs and what do you listen to?
And because that is such a perfect, I mean, like that to me is, you know, when you're on that bus out of town and, you know, you've got your headphones in, like, what's over this next hill? Like that to me is a lot of the, when I look back, I think about those moments of excitement of sort of, you know, there's curiosity coming up. There's some other gem to find just ahead of us. And this bus or this train or this boat is going a place I've never been. And so kind of, yeah, the soundtrack to those moments can be important. And I think that's a great one.
Can I tell you really quickly a story that, so this, like this title is, Oh, I Wept is making me think about?
Sure, please.
So the first time I left New Zealand, I fell in love with it. It is the place I hope that, you know, if I'm just dropped someplace for the rest of my life, that's where it is. But the first time I left, I was lucky enough. It's the only time ever it happened in my life. I was upgraded to first class. And I mean, I had no idea what to expect in first class, except maybe bigger seats. But anyway, so I'm looking out the window as, you know, people are still boarding, and I started like crying a little, and I felt this tap on my shoulder, and I was like, come on, you know, bad timing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a little more insistent. So I like turn around, and I've got like tears on my cheeks, and it's a flight attendant, and she's holding like a cocktail, and she's like, oh no, you're going to need another one of these. Oh. So she came back with another one, and I was like, I love first class.
There we go. Well, hey, I hope you have a chance to get back to New Zealand soon. And yeah, put that on either when you're leaving or when you're landing. And I think it'll cue you up for a great trip. Man, New Zealand is so high on my list, dude. I've like heard so many wonderful things about New Zealand. One day.
Evan Rice, thanks for the conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too, Sean. Thanks very much.
I realize that travel is a privilege. I know this because, as I said at the outset, it was simply not an option for me and my family when I was coming up, something I couldn't feasibly do until I was well into adulthood. And even then, only because I made travel a defining characteristic of my life and structured my life to allow for it. But something I've been thinking about lately is that the time spent in my youth, or my pre-travel life generally, when I was devouring anything travel-related without actually traveling, was a very valuable experience. It shaped my sense of wonder and curiosity about the world, about other people, about how people communicate, what they eat, how or if they worship, etc. And in turn, this informed my own development. When I couldn't travel, and in lieu of travel, I learned languages of countries I wanted to someday visit. I learned how to cook food from places on my bucket list. I learned the history of certain regions and countries. And it broke down barriers in my own mind. While I didn't yet have the means to touch down in those places, the borders had been erased. My world was large, even when it was small. And most importantly, it has instilled in me a sense of compassion and community that has helped to inform every aspect of my life. Visiting other places and other people, whether it be in our minds, in our dreams, or in reality, is a powerful force for connection. All right, check back next Friday and every Friday for a new episode of Deep Dive. Chat soon, folks.